you take the piss out of Jolson again, and I will remove your iPod from its tiny nano sheath and push it up your cock. And then I'll plug some speakers up your arse and put it on a shuffle with my fucking fist. I tell you, and every time I hear something that I don't like, which will be every time that something comes on, I will skip to the next track by crushing your balls.
Oh, fuck's sake. He's miming. He's pretending to do the intro, everyone. But it's because we're talking about the 1920s. He's doing it silently. Oh, and he's doing a little dance. Oh, God, there he is. Oh, it's the advent of sound. Hello, Adam.
I was going to sort of feel like you would think that I was on mute or something accidentally, but that didn't work out.
I knew exactly what you were doing. I knew you were planning some kind of shenanigans with the way your face looks.
I mean, because most like films
smile
in the night...
on your face.
Because all the films of the 1920s up until the later part of the decade were, you know, it was, you know, sound wasn't invented up until, you know, it wasn't invented until the jazz singer came out with the Al Jolson film.
Mm. It's this kind of important trivia that you come to Holmes movies for. Yes, the 1920s
yes.
are a famous decade in film, mostly because the films are silent. It's also, I think, probably the decade in film where people have pretended to see the most films. But haven't actually watched them.
I sometimes like to go through people's Letterboxd accounts, you know, people who I know, not like critics.
You're not going through people's letterboxes because that's letterboxed a crime. You're going
accounts.
Through last
letterboxed exactly. accounts, not actual letterboxes. Because
yeah, don't go
I'm
through
not,
people's mail.
I'm not that much of a creep. Okay. All right, I'm not a creep, not a pedo or anything like that. Anyway, I like to go through people's letterboxed accounts and I like to go through their films to see, like, because sometimes I like to see how far people's watches go to. Like, do they, you know, stop at a certain decade or do people actually watch films from the 1920s? Because I feel like nowadays, given that I feel like everything, like most people who I follow online, a lot of people tend to talk about films unless it's like a Star Wars or a Back to the Future or some big film that's a big IP, most films like pre-1990, a lot of people don't really talk about it unless they're like real big film nerds like us.
Yeah, well, there are a few people. I mean, there's I follow someone called Silent Dawn, which I feel like they do a lot of movies. And then there's that wonderful person who runs the website Movies Silently, which is full of silent film reviews, and they have accounts on social media and on Letterboxd. So there are people out there, but most people, you're right, most people don't watch films from the 1920s, which is a shame because it is a great decade of film, and just because films are silent doesn't mean they're not worth watching, and they can be incredibly gripping, moving, funny. If you are listening to this and you're not someone who watches movies from the 1920s, like Dougie, for example, who's too, you know, busy being Dougie to watch movies from the 1920s, well, you should check them out. So treat this list as a list of recommendations. Now, if you are someone who likes silent films and you think our list is bullshit, remember, all lists are bullshit, including yours. But this is our last top 10 for a while. And
yeah.
Do you want to tell the people what we're going to be doing next?
So what we're going to be doing next is that we are going to be doing trilogy episodes where we're going to be talking about favorite trilogies or trilogy films, you know, talking about trilogies, basically.
Yes. The rule of three.
Rule of three.
Three,
yes.
Shall it be the trilogy, the three. So stay tuned to Holmes Movies for more chat about trilogies. And also we'll continue to do the Movies and Me, with where we interview celebrities like my friend's dad and Callum about their
yeah.
favorite film, but you know, I think they've been really fun, and so we're going to keep doing that as well, and obviously if there were to be some kind of massive earth-shaking event, like I don't know, they bring back they do a remake of the John Ford's like Cavalry trilogy. Well, there's a trilogy, so we could just do that. You know what I mean? If like, there's a huge thing, we might do a special episode. But otherwise, we're going to be doing trilogies for a while. We're going to be doing interviews. And yeah, so let's do the 1920s. Let's kick off this top 10. Do you want to go? Who goes first?
How about you go first? I think I'd like to hear what your top 10, number 10 film is.
So my number 10 is a Buster Keaton movie called The Cameraman. It's my favorite Buster Keaton film, which is why I've put it on here. And I mean, there's not much to say about Buster. It's just that he is, well, I mean, there is loads to say about Buster, but I guess it's like, how much how much you want to say in a tiny segment of a podcast. But it's just, you know, he's one of the most beautifully melancholic comedic performers in the history of cinema. His deadpan expression as he goes through the sort of madcap adventure is just something to behold. I mean, you may have seen clips of his online. You may have seen other movies like Steamboat Bill Jr. or Sherlock Jr. or The General, which I think is kind of an interesting, you know, all of them are really interesting. The General in particular is sort of an interesting riff on the Civil War, again, with that weirdly pro-Southern focus. I chose to look past that one. But it does have that amazing train sequence at the end. But The Cameraman, I think, is genuinely one of the funniest and most just like astonishingly creative of his entries. And it, again, it plays with, you know, like with Sherlock Jr., it sort of plays within the film with the idea of cinema. It's so, I mean, it's just such a delight. And to see him sort of fail upwards in a way in this film as this hopeless wannabe newspaper camera a news cameraman who's also sort of fallen in love with a girl along the way. It is a heartwarming and genuinely hilarious picture, and it features a monkey sidekick, and who doesn't want to have a monkey sidekick in their comedy film? So I agonized for ages. It's really difficult to do these lists, as you know, and I was thinking, God, do I do Chaplin? Do I do Keaton? Or do I do both? I decided in the end that much as I love Chaplin, my heart belongs to Buster Keaton. And I encourage you all to watch The Cameraman. It is just a hell of a lot of fun. Over to you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we also have done a Holmes Movies Recommends episode on The Cameraman. So if you wanted to hear a longer episode where we're talking about the film, you can check that episode out.
I'd completely forgotten about that.
So my number 10 is a film from 1929, and it's kind of a documentary, kind of an editing experiment sort of film, and it's Dzika Vertov's film Man with a Movie Camera. And essentially there's not really a plot with this film. It is essentially just a cameraman wanders around a city or a town and just captures everyday life, urban life, a lot of quick cuts, trains, factories, people. It's a very interesting snapshot of everyday life. And I feel like a lot of editing techniques, like jump cuts and, you know, aspects like that of editing that have, you know, been carried on into modern cinema, I think that sort of started there. And also it's just, you know, it's an interesting film about everyday life, a day in the life of this town, and it's only an hour long. So, you know, it's not going to take up too much of your time, and it's great filmmaking, and it's very well put together, and the music's really
good. It's very famous. I mean, it's extremely famous. And the other thing about, I mean, this is the cool thing about, I think, about silent cinema as well, is especially when it's got this semi-documentary quality like Man with the Movie Camera, is it's a kind of time travel. I mean, you go back to pre-war Europe and see, you know, images of a time that just feels impossibly far away. I just love the way it brings history closer. So, yeah, I need to watch Man with the Movie Camera. That's a great entry. So
I did. I had to switch. I sort of swapped my films around. Originally I had Three Bad Men by John Ford, but I swapped it around because I thought Man with the Movie Camera would be much, I feel like, is a little bit better than Three Bad Men.
I don't have any John Ford silent films on my list, but I will just say Three Bad Men is a great little western from the 1920s, really worth watching if you get the chance. But it's not in our top 10. My number 9 is a film that I don't think you've seen. It's also from 1929. It's a British film called A Cottage on Dartmoor, which sounds very bucolic.
I have not seen it, and I have not heard of it.
Yeah. It's directed by Anthony Asquith, and it's I thought you might have some Hitchcock in there, so I decided that I would choose this kind of Hitchcock-adjacent film. And it is a thriller, and it's all about like a fugitive. He goes out to hide out in a cottage on Dartmoor, and it's done brilliantly in this kind of like, first you're in the cottage and then you get this flashback, and the plot all hinges on this love triangle with this one very jealous guy all in a barber's. So there's all these scenes of people like shaving while they give each other like evil looks. And then, you know, it culminates in this, you know, very sort of tense way. And so it blends that kind of like, not comedy of manners exactly, but that way in which, you know, film will sometimes set a conflict in a very, very specific location, in this case, a barbershop. But then also, you know, it takes us out to the sort of the windy moors and the cottage. And it's just a really real gem of like early British cinema. And you've not heard of it. I hadn't heard of it until I watched it. It's really... it's not well known, but I think it is as good as many of the Hitchcock films of this era, and definitely worth tracking down. I believe that you can find it on Amazon in the USA to stream, but there's probably DVDs out there. I wouldn't be surprised if the BFI had a copy. So yeah, track it down and watch it. It's really good.
I think the good thing about most silent films is I feel like a lot of them aren't really like protected by copyright. So there's just, you know, if you go on YouTube, you type in a film that's from the silent movie era, you're bound to find it. And most of the films are in very good quality. So maybe it will be on YouTube as well.
Some of them are, some of them aren't, you know, there can be a difference. I mean, part of the problem with things being in the public domain is that the, sometimes the soundtracking or the image quality can be a bit funny, but yeah, no, you're right, there are good ones out there. I mean, the weirdest, so the one film that's in the public, going back to Buster Keaton, is The General. My DVD copy of it has just whoever made the DVD just put on Scott Joplin rags under the thing, which just really discordant, where it's like it's Civil War set thing and he's driving it on the train, it's like and it's like, wait a minute, this doesn't work, and it also doesn't fit with the action of the film. And I think some of the best DVD releases or you know, restorations of silent films where they've taken, you know, the soundtrack and made a new one, you know, specifically for the film, well, they're basically the most successful, because you've got to match the music to the action, because otherwise you're not going to be able to, because there is no dialogue to listen to. So the music is a way of pulling you into the action. I mean, this is why in the old days they used to have actually like an organist in the cinema playing along to the movie.
Yeah.
You know, because it would just sort of enhance the experience and draw people in. Anyway, all, you know, all to say, be careful about which versions you watch. What's your number nine?
So my number nine is a F.W. Murnau film, and it's from 1927. Murnau, and it is Faust.
Faust? I don't have Faust on my list, but it's a great film. I've seen it.
It's very good. So. It's a very, very... my old movie club made up of friends from European Film College. We haven't had a meeting for a very long time because everyone's very busy, and we did actually... Someone chose this film to watch, and I hadn't seen it. It was my first watch. And my sort of first two sentence, well, my sort of summation of the film started with "Behold, cinema," and it's an amazing film. I feel like Murnau was one of those directors that very much defined silent movie cinema, particularly German expressionism, and that sort of style carries on into films like Tim Burton's filmography, like his Batman films, Sleepy Hollow, and even films like The Crow, the original The Crow with Brandon Lee, that also has a very kind of German expressionist feel about it. And I think
I think German expressionism is going to come up once or twice on this episode.
I feel that might be the case.
There's a couple of German films.
It's a very unique use of props and sets. The, you know, great ominous use.
Oh, the set design in Faust is amazing.
Yeah, the shadow work is great. There's some great use of just like some very old school special effects that mostly people would, you know, you do on a computer these days. I love like that. I think it's almost like watching a magic show.
It has a sort of Fantasia Night on Bald Mountain quality in some parts of it, you know, the shadows sort of spreading over the village kind of thing, you know.
Yeah, I love that. I love
Emil
that
Jennings
shot.
Too.
Yeah, Emil Jannings Mephisto is that he steals the whole film. He's brilliant. I love his kind of like Machiavellian performance that he has. I mean, for all those people who, you know, who read and are familiar with literature, you know, Faust is, you know, about a guy who wants to, you know everything. No, it's a man who craves knowledge and in some ways power. And he makes a deal with the devil and sells his soul. And I mean, there's different versions
never
of Faust.
Never a good idea. Just never a good idea.
Never a good idea. It's interesting because he knows where he's going to go, but he's still like power, power, power. And is like, oh, no, I feel like I can get away from this. Nope, you're going to hell. And there's different versions of Faust. I know there's the Christopher Marlowe version of Faust, which I'm mostly familiar with. And then there's the German Goethe's version, which is God yeah. And the devil kind of fighting over a soul. I think this is the one that is, I think, inspired this movie. But yeah, it's a great piece of theater, and this is a great piece of movie making, which had me going, how did they do that many times?
So, yeah, mesmerizing, definitely that
mesmerizing film, worth a watch.
Yeah, well, we're gonna stay in Germany for my number eight, which is the G.W. Pabst film, also from 1929. A lot of films from 1929. Which is Pandora's Box with the iconic Louise Brooks, who had the fringe, the iconic fringe haircut. It's great. It's a story of, you know, a young woman who has a series of, let's just say, unfortunate love affairs in Germany, but she ends up in the, you know, the smoky, foggy streets of London town. It's just a super movie and full of just brilliant performances. And I think it's a great sort of early feminist, exactly, film, but a great film with a sort of strong female character at the heart of it. Like, it would not work without Louise Brooks. And she became an icon because of this. I mean, her like, so many actors, like Jannings as well. I mean, he tried in the sound era, but he never really made it beyond silent cinema. The style of performances was so unique, it feels like, in the 1910s and 1920s. Louise Brooks's career didn't really go much beyond the 1920s, but this film kind of writes her into the stars a little bit. And you know, she becomes this you know, this real icon of like she is like the archetype of the flapper, you know what I mean? And the 1920s lady of the jazz age. It is a German movie, as I say, but it's it kind of feels like, because of Louise Brooks's presence, it has this kind of American quality running through it as well. And there are actually a lot of films I think we're going to talk about that will combine sort of the best of Hollywood and the best of German filmmaking. This is kind of an example of that. So it's just a, you know, just really good early drama, but it's got loads of heart, this film, loads of light moments. And I think it's got some good comments on like the inherent shittiness of men. So I couldn't recommend it enough. Pandora's Box, G.W. Pabst, check it out. It's on the Criterion channel and also available through HBO Max. Look at that. But you can buy it on DVD.
I think Eureka Entertainment, I think, has it as part of their Masters of Cinema collection. I might be wrong, or it's one of those people.
We give Eureka Entertainment a lot of bloody free advertising on this podcast.
Yeah, that and Arrow Video and things like that. But anyway, so that was your number eight, Pandora's Box.
Correct.
So my number eight is a film from Sweden, and is Axen.
Oh, well, film from Sweden, but don't forget, Danish director.
Yes, Danish director, Benjamin Christensen. And it's basic. I mean, if you know what the translation of
witchcraft through the ages.
Yes, and it's an incredibly, like, it's very frightening, and also at the same time, it's a very, like, it's kind of a horny film as well. It's very, like, very sexual.
A little bit.
Yeah,
a lot of gratuitous, a lot of gratuitous nudity.
Yeah, lot of like doing like devils, people playing devils, doing stuff with their tongues, and like yeah, stuff like that. Yeah, it's quite an unsettling film. And
right, also, just say what it is. It's fucked up. movie is fucked up.
I mean, for a film that came out early 20s, like, it really kind of pushed the envelope a little bit, and I feel like
it pushed the envelope right up your ass. Like, it's just, and it filled the envelope with toads and pushed it up your ass. It is a completely nutso blutso film, this one, and it and I love it. No, Haxan is great. It's not in my top 10, but I absolutely love it. Honestly, guys, have a Halloween party, put this on, project it onto your walls, and just have it playing in the background. It's perfect. But also watch it, actually. You know, films aren't just decoration, but yeah. It is just like, it is deliciously mad. And I think it actually does, like, it has a serious purpose, which is to go back and look at the way in which this engine of oppression was used against women. You know, I do think there is a bit of that in the film, yeah, alongside the gratuitous nudity. And I think it, you know, it has some historical points to make. And I think it does sort of capture the medieval quite well. But I just love, like, all the images in this movie. It is tremendous. I need to rewatch it.
Yeah, I think on the Tartan cinema DVD that I borrowed from you, I think you could watch, like, the original version with, like, music that was composed at the time, and it's a newly composed soundtrack, which I think it does fit quite well with the film. But then you can watch, like, a recut version where I feel the author William S. Burroughs is narrating underneath it or something like that.
What? This is on my DVD?
Yeah, it's on the DVD, yeah.
Oh, I want this back. I want to listen to the Burroughs cut.
Witches cool. of the medieval times.
Right. Okay.
He does sound like that. If anyone's listened to that audio tape of him and everything.
Devil tongues and, or maybe, I don't, yeah, it's fun. I was trying to do Burroughs, anyway, but sort of merged into Iggy Pop there.
Yeah. Didn't Iggy Pop do a whole radio thing about William S. Burroughs once?
Yeah, for This American Life. I think it was like two episodes on it.
Right. Yeah, I didn't just make that up. Okay, anyway, we strayed wildly off topic there. Okay, so I'm going to tell you about my number seven, right?
Yeah.
My number seven is a Swedish director and doing an American film from 1928. It's Victor Sjöström's, or Victor Seaström, as he was known in the States, The Wind. Which is it's kind of a Western, actually. So there is we've managed to get a Western in here, but it's more than that. It's this young lady played by Lillian Gish, who is like the film star of the 1910s, and 1920s, but really she sort of comes into her own in the D.W. Griffith movies. She moves to the West into this creepy as fuck farmhouse ranch place out in the middle of nowhere in the Mojave Desert, and it is just windy, like really, really fucking windy all the time. And
hence the title, The Wind.
Hence the title, The Wind. It's not about farting, it's about the actual wind. And she basically goes mad and is tormented by the weather and by sinister goings on. And she has to she has to fight off the, fight off the presence of, these sinister people. And there's also like this like family discord within the house and everything. And it's extremely atmospheric. And it has this wonderful shot where the wind is blowing and she's imagining it. And because you can't hear the wind because it's a silent movie, they show this kind of film of a horse galloping onto a transparent surface, so we're below the horse and the wind is blowing around and we just see this white horse galloping, and it gives this amazing sense of like noise, right, and chaos, and the disturbing the way in which it's disturbing her mind. And Gish's performance, as you'd expect, is brilliant. So I urge people to watch that. It's kind of difficult to get hold of, but I think, you know, it might be one of those YouTube, you know, just look around a little bit, you know, 1928, not sure that puts it in the public domain, but it's not far away. But seriously, a great film, one which I think all Lillian Gish fans should see. And I know you're out there, because she's still, I think she still has a loyal following. I think it's also because she did do films after The Silent, you know, she's in Night of the Hunter and she's in various other movies. So
yeah,
I think that, you know, she had a very long career. So anyway, yeah, The Wind. What's your number seven?
Yeah, sorry, just before I get to my number seven, did he direct, Victor Sjostrom, did he direct The Phantom Carriage?
He did. And he did. He's the main character in Ingmar Bergman's Wild Strawberries. He was a huge inspiration for Ingmar Bergman.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Bergman would have, you know, he would have made a killing in the silent movie era, because a lot of his movies have that kind of silent movie era imagery. He would have done
better. Yeah, big time. Yeah, I think, I mean, his film, that film I mentioned, Wild Strawberries, is just a love letter to Sjostrom.
Yeah.
What's your number seven?
Great film. My number seven is a Charlie Chaplin film, and it's The Kid.
Oh, thank goodness it's on here, because I was agonizing over this. And I chose Buster Keaton. I love The Kid. What a wonderful film.
Yeah, the Kid is played by Jackie Coogan, and he gives a great performance as well, along with...
I think it's one of the best in the history of child actors.
Yeah, and it's a wonderful film. It almost kind of feels like a pantomime, because it's a film about a child that gets separated from its mother, and then the tramp, played by Charlie Chaplin, his like famous persona, he takes care of the boy and, you know, protects it and cares for it as if it's his own child. And there's moments in the movie where it's like, the woman's over there, the mum's there, take the boy to the mother and everything. And it's just pure joy. It's a good feel-good film. And there's some great physical comedy as well, which, you know, Charlie Chaplin's films have that. And you know, he was a master at it. And just, you know, just seeing what he built for himself in that period. And he also carried on into the sound era as well, maybe with not the biggest amount of success, because he did get blacklisted at one point, and then spent most of his life in Switzerland before he came back and got a very long standing ovation at the Oscars when he got his honorary award.
Yeah, it's a shame what happened to him, and it's interesting how, you know, in the sound, you see a film like Modern Times where he blends sound and silent comedy, and it's just it's still so good. It's like, why? But you know, comedy does, it's subject to the whims of fashion and whatever, but The Kid feels, yeah, as you say, it has this real Victorian quality. But and I think one of the things that adds is a sense of genuine poignancy. I mean, there's that bit where the kid gets taken away from him,
yeah,
and it's like fucking heartbreaking, and the Jackie Coogan is so good at this like silent, you know, perform. That's the other thing, is this kid is acting without being able to make, you know, the one thing that kids can do is they can make cute sounds, and this kid doesn't have that option, so he has to do it all with his physical presence and with his face, and he's just so amazing at it. And I just love the chemistry between them in this film.
Yeah, they had a really good, you believe their relationship in the film, it's very believable.
Totally. And I do love it. Glad it's on the list. So at number six, I'm going to pick a film that I think we may both have, and it's another for Murnau film, another FW Murnau, and it is Nosferatu from 1922, a symphony des Grauens. The original Dracula film.
I also have Nosferatu on my list, but it's a lot higher up on mine.
Okay, well, why don't we park that for now and come back to it? So what's your number six?
So my number six is a Buster Keaton film, and I've only seen this Buster Keaton film, and I know that sounds very bad because I'm known for my love of film, and there are certain films I haven't gotten to yet, and Buster Keaton is one of those films.
Shock horror. There are certain films that Anders has not seen. You heard it here first, people.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, the first film of his that I watched, and you know, I wanted to watch more of them, is Sherlock Jr., which is a very...
Such a joy.
It's great bit of physical comedy as well, and also like that, what you were saying before, that great deadpan face that he has. You know, he had a great physical presence, and you know, really, you know, he did enough, but while doing quite, you know, he didn't have to like overdo it so much as like Charlie Chaplin did. He really gets by with just like a look, and it's like, ah, brilliant.
Yeah, he has this way in which he can just sort of, he's got these big eyes and this long face, and he's so physically adroit. It's actually interesting how you can see in there's a swimming pool scene in The Cameraman where he you see his bare arms, you see just how like built he was, because he's so athletic to do, yeah. you know, so many of these stunts. Oh yeah, it's just, I mean, his performance, you know, is phenomenal. And again, like Chaplin, I mean, not just like, I mean, he had an even worse fall from grace in that way. I mean, he ended up like, was he living in a trailer? I mean, he lost a lot of, momentum and a lot of money. I mean, his career really just like ran out into the sand, and he did have that brief revival, you know, and was heralded especially by French critics. And I mean, I know he was a huge influence on Jacques Tati.
Yeah, definitely.
As was Chaplin.
Yeah. The Buster Keaton and Charlie Chaplin, that influence goes straight into Jacques Tati's Monsieur Hulot. And that carries on into Mr. Bean, Rowan Atkinson's character.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. Well, we're halfway through. And I think it's a damn good list so far.
Yeah, it's very good.
So let me tell you a story, something that happened to me recently. As you know, our mother is actually staying with us.
Yes.
As with me and my wife as we speak. The reason is that someone needs to look after the baby because daycare is closed this week.
Easter holiday.
Yeah, spring break.
Right.
Our mother, the baby's grandmother, has bravely come across the Atlantic to take on childcare duties. But of course, someone had to pick her up from the airport. And that was me. And I had to do that at the end of rather a long day. And when I got home from, you know, work and picking up the baby and picking up my wife to drop them off, I really didn't feel like taking the drive to Boston. And I was knackered. And what would you normally do in that situation?
A good caffeine boost, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You drive down the highway like Gene Hackman in The French Connection, just like... you know what I did? I reached for my little friend, Magic Mind. I drank it. I drove down the highway, not like Gene Hackman in French Connection. It was more like Ryan Gosling in Drive. Just like focused, quiet, smooth. No issues. Nodding along as I listened to the podcast, which I was focusing on. Because you know what Magic Mind is, Anders? It's a mental performance shot. So it's not just good for productivity. It's good for focus. So I was driving like Ryan Gosling, but I was listening to a podcast like... someone who's really good at listening to podcasts because I was so focused. And honestly, this Magic Mind stuff is just terrific. So yeah, well, what's the story with Magic Mind? Well, let me tell you, folks. It's the world's first mental performance shot. It's this little bottle of green liquid that's very, very tasty and is full of all natural ingredients, including Bacopa Monieri, which is not a small village in Tuscany, but it is a nootropic that improves attention span. You've got your old friend Matcha, you know Matcha, you're a Matcha man, and Cordyceps mushrooms.
Just a FYI, it's the good Cordyceps, not the Cordyceps that turn you into a monster from The Last of Us.
You haven't seen The Last of Us. You've seen The Last of Us. Yes, the good kind of mushrooms. The good kind of mushrooms. Very powerful mushroom, not a magic mushroom, but it can reduce inflammation and helps your immune system. So just a great little juice, which you can get. I mean, let's be honest. Who wouldn't want to try it listening to this recommendation? Who wouldn't want to be like Ryan Gosling and driving down the highway towards Boston to pick up a pensioner from Denmark? Yo, so you want to go, yo, what? You, the listener, want to go to magicmind.com/homes. That's magicmind.com/HOLMES. And you want to use that very special offer code, HOLMES20, that's HOLMES20, to get, you know, you get yourself a hefty discount. Get as much as 56% off. That's like better than half price. It's practically free. You should do it. Honestly, I'm not the only one who's recommending this. The Kardashians. Yeah, you heard of them. And apparently one of the best surfers in the world, who I've never heard of, Koa Rothman, is also talking about it on their podcast. So it's like the guys from Point Break are drinking this stuff. They're focused. So get involved with the Kardashians and surfers and us and drink Magic Mind. Go to magicmind.com/homes, HOLMES, and use the very special offer code HOLMES20. 20 to you know, to start your adventure with Magic Mind and to reclaim your brain, Magic Mind. Okay, number five. What have we got? So I've got a Hollywood film at number five, but a Hollywood film that was made as kind of you know, not as a crowd pleaser, but as a you know, a pet project of the director in question, King Vidor, 1928 film called The Crowd, which is set in New York City and is a film about a young couple who, you know, meet and fall in love amidst this huge city teeming with individuals, and they go through the struggles of young parenthood, of trying to find a place in the world, and they suffer some real tragedies along the way, and it has this incredible opening and closing shot where you in the first shot it takes you up this skyscraper and into this huge dystopian office building, very similar actually office building to the one in The Apartment, which I think was an inspiration for this film. And then at the end, the couple at the center of the film are actually in a cinema, and the camera zooms out and then they're lost in the crowd. So there's this real sense of like urban alienation going on. It's one of the first great New York movies, in my opinion. And I think it kind of sets precedent for the city as a setting for like human interest stories of like ordinary people caught in the storm and drang of modern life. And it's just, again, really, really good performances. You've got James Murray and Eleanor Boardman as, you know, the main two characters, lots of other great like supporting players. It's a crisp and quick 98 minutes. And pretty easy to get hold of, as I say, I think you can get it on DVD. But you can also stream it various places. So
yeah,
Another one of those that I think it's not in the first rank of really famous silent films like Nosferatu or the Chaplin ones, but it is kind of in that you've got to dig for it a little bit, but it's really, really worth watching. And I think was, and probably remains to some extent, a huge influence. So King Vidor. You know, great director. Check it out.
Yep.
What's your number five?
My number five is from Russia, the Soviet Union at this point. And it's a film I watched for the first time recently. You know, it's a film I have been aware of for a long time because of its reference. There's a baby carriage, which is used as in a gunfight sequence in The Untouchables, and it's Sergei Eisenstein's film The Battleship Potemkin,
which I have my number four, so this is perfect.
I was amazed by it. I thought it was brilliant, but at the same time I was also quite horrified by it. It's a very frightening and very graphic film, and I feel like it's a film, I mean, a lot of films in this sort of period that I've talked about and that I have on my list, they all have very sort of provocative and very kind of like images that stick with you. But I think the thing that I feel is very important and relevant about Battleship Potemkin is its idea of this, you know, how revolutions start, and this idea of getting rid of, you know, this, how, you know, governments and armies repress people and things like that. And I do feel like the movie does take on a whole new level of relevancy since the death of Alexei Navalny.
Right. Yep. Oh, you're getting topical. I mean, it's talk about movies as time travel. I mean, this is the thing about these regimes, you know, the Soviet Union on the one hand and Nazi Germany on the other. You know, they both embraced modernity in a big way, and they were both made very successful use of film. And I don't think that I would put Eisenstein in the same category as Leni Riefenstahl, for example, but he was making Soviet propaganda films. This is a propaganda film for the Soviet Union, and it's great. And it's just a really, like, you watch this film and I'm like, getting to the end of it and the credits roll, and I'm like grabbing my fucking pitchfork and marching out to destroy capitalism. You know, I'm there. You know, I'm like, let's go, motherfuckers. But I I find it just a really yeah, as you say, like a visceral movie. The famous
the Odessa
sequence
steps.
On the Odessa steps is, I mean, it's wild. Sorry, there's speaking of baby carriages, there's now baby crying in the background.
I can't hear it. Maybe it won't show up on the podcast.
Okay, well, if I there is, yeah, somewhere in the recesses. The baby is being looked after. Don't worry, listeners.
Adam is a good father.
Well, anyway, yeah, Battleship Potemkin. Yeah, that's a real. I think we're getting into this top five is going to be full of some heavy hitters, I think.
Yeah.
So it's my number four. So what's your number four?
So my number four is a film that's also been, I'm just double checking. Yes, this one's at number four. So this is a film from 1927. It's also been a huge influence on a lot of people, from sci-fi to Queen's Radio Gaga, and that is Fritz Lang's Metropolis.
So interestingly, that's my number three. So I see what's happening here.
Okay.
Yeah, this is a brilliant film.
Practical effects, but also like what you were talking about with the crowd and the city and the people, and also this is also a film about revolution and status and the upper class keeping the lower class down in the holes and the factories, and it's a wild film as well, and also very evocative as well.
Yeah, apparently Hitler was a big fan of it, which is interesting given given a lot of what's going on in the film, but also a kind of illustrative of what the Nazi self-conception was, you know, this kind of like populist force.
Yeah.
But when you see the workers marching into these kind of furnaces in the film, you can't help think about what happened in the 1940s under the Third Reich. But yeah, no, this film, I mean, because Lang fled Germany, as we talked about in the 1930s episode,
yeah,
but his wife and the writer of this movie, Thea von Habel, stayed and became kind of a stooge for Goebbels and everything. And they really wanted Lang to stay in Germany and keep working and for the Nazis. But he you know, obviously had the courage of his convictions. And he made so many great films right through the rest of his career and became this sort of absolute icon. I mean, he made wonderful Hollywood films. But he also has before he left, you know, just a ton of great German films to his name, and this is the greatest of them all. It's a bit of a beast. It's like 2.5 hours, isn't it? It's well worth your time.
It is well worth your time. I do remember watching this in my film school in England, because we were talking about silent movies, and this was the movie that we'd watched, and I was very excited because I hadn't seen it before, and I was familiar with it because of the woman robot, because, which is, you know, essentially C-3PO, but
expressionist. Scary C-3PO.
Yeah. And it was also funny because we weren't looking at silent films, we were looking at like German expressionism, and we were looking at this, and also we were looking at one of the Batman films that Tim Burton had directed, and we were looking at how German expressionism was coming into other aspects like music videos, like Express Yourself, the Madonna video, which I feel if you listen to Born This Way and Express Yourself, they're both very quite linked, they have the same sort of tunes. And also we watched the Radio Gaga music video, which uses clips from the film.
Yeah, I mean, it has had a long, I mean, this is definitely one of those films that people pretend to have seen, you know, to sound cool. I love the way it evokes the future, because this is the thing, is that it's futuristic, but it's also 1920s, and so it's like people traveling around in planes. They're biplanes, but obviously the other influence of this film is Blade Runner.
Oh yeah, totally.
I mean, with all the, you know, people, the higher ups in the high places and the lower downs in the low places and everything else, and all the sort of dystopians,
humanity,
the city that never ends.
Yeah,
and let's be honest, I mean, this is the stupidest thing in the world, but it's also probably a big influence on George Lucas and Coruscant.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, definitely. That's very true.
So yeah, so there's something. I mean, Metropolis has had such a long afterlife. It has. It's a important historical picture for so many. I mean, it sort of transcends the just being a mere film, but it is also a really good film.
Yeah.
Do you know that bit where the actress, what's her name, Birgitta Helm, is before she gets abducted and turned into an evil robot, she's being stalked through like these caves by Rotwang, who's like the sort of evil, sinister force at the heart of the movie, and he's like stalking her through the caves. It's Rudolf Kleinroger. I mean, that's just such a great, such a great sequence. Yeah. So this, and then there's all the other, you know, there's the climax and this big cathedral. There's the, you know, the images just of people like going to work, and then there's the revolution. And it's very, I think it pairs really well with, Potemkin with Eisenstein stuff, but there's like this kind of sci-fi element to it that I think makes it just extra cinematic or something.
Yeah, it definitely has like a Bride of Frankenstein feel to it as well, with the scientist bringing the robot to life.
Oh yeah, yeah, that's true actually. And Universal Horror Films, I think, would draw heavily on German Expressionism. So yeah, there's even more influence for you. So that's my number three. So what's your number three?
This is going to be very funny if this is your number two.
Yeah, no, it's the third time in a row.
So my number three, brace yourselves, is another Murnau film, and it's Sunrise, A Song of Two Humans.
That is my number two.
Are you serious?
I am serious.
Jesus Christ.
That is my number two. It's one of my favorite movies. It is a glorious film. Sunrise. Can I start this time?
Yeah, sure, sure, of course.
So Murnau went to Hollywood, where he had a short but amazing career. You know, he died in a car crash, didn't he? But he produced this in just intensely wonderful movie about the city is at the heart of it. It opens with all these images of cityscapes, but then it takes us out to this bucolic landscape and this couple who've fallen on hard times, and where the man played by George O'Brien is tempted away by this flapper girl who looks a lot like Louise Brooks actually, but is played by Margaret Livingston. Uh-huh. But his wife, played by Janet Gaynor, is really the star of the film, and he at one point he's tempted to murder her, and then he changes his mind at the last minute, and they have this day where the two of them go to the city and sort of reconcile, and the moments of reconciliation are some of the most beautiful moments of like some of the beautiful depictions of the love between two people that I have ever seen, like not just in silent cinema but in any film. Their performances are just like beyond touching, and I think it's the direction and just the way the sort of soundtrack and the cinematography sort of work together. It's that's sort of like the peak of the film for me. And then they have this day in the city, and then they go back home, but there's a sort of, obviously there's a bit of a crisis at the end that they also, you know, spoiler alert, they also overcome. But
The spinster woman is thrown out of town. Or chased out of town.
Oh, the flapper woman. Yeah. She's run out on a rail at the end, isn't she? What are your thoughts on Sunrise?
Yeah, it's a very joyous film. I think it's a lovely film about a couple falling in love again, and I think finding that spark. Mm. I think there's many moments where he's just like looking at her and kind of, you know, feeling that passion again. I think that's a very moving aspect of the film. And also like when the film sort of takes a turn towards when they go back to their village, I think that's also a moment where you're just like, no, they were so happy and everything. And it all goes well, but still does make you feel a bit worried for them, and that it's just going to end in tears and, you know, end on such like a dour note. And then, you know, but it doesn't. And it, you know, it's a very...
Gives you the Hollywood ending.
It's a nice little Hollywood ending, yeah. It's a very, I don't know, I feel like if he made this in Germany, maybe it would have ended on a slightly different note. But no, it's a lovely film. It's well shot, edited. The editing is very good as well. Great use of camera work, and also the whole... you know, there's some tense moments as well where you're not quite sure, is he going to go through with it? Is he not? And yeah, it's a wonderful.
Yeah, the bit in the robo where he's thinking of murdering her is terrifying.
It's very Hitchcock.
Very. Yeah, anyway, Sunrise is very easy to see. I think of all the films on this list, I don't know, it's like maybe the one that you would, I mean, you, the general listener, would like the most. I don't know. I mean, there are a lot of very accessible films on this list, but I feel like Sunrise is one of the ones where genuinely about 10 minutes in, you will forget it's silent. You don't need the dialogue.
Yeah, exactly.
So, and the performances are so real that, again, you stay in the movie. It never relinquishes you in that way. There's just one bit where there is it like a pig escapes or something and they're chasing it through a bar. That's a little silly. But then
that's like a scene out of a John Ford film almost.
Right. Yeah. Sort of. Yeah. Anyway, hijinks. So that was my number two. So what's your number two?
Funny if this is your number one is the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari.
So that is not on my list.
So that's my number two. You've seen it, right?
Yeah, it's just not in my top 10.
Yes.
I like it. I think it's become very, it's one of those films that people pretend to see. And I think it's become a bit of a sacred cow with good reason, because it's a really, really iconic film. But I think, yeah, tell the people why they should watch The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, which, by the way, is a fantastic title.
It is a great title, and it sounds better in German as well. Das Kabinett, Das Dr. Caligari. Yeah, so it's directed by Robert...
I thought you said that in a Werner Herzog voice.
Das Kabinett des Dr. Caligari.
He's in the cabinet, and then he goes out at night and does evil things.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, this is a bit of a tangent, but speaking of Werner Herzog, you know he's collaborating with Nicolas Cage again?
What?
It's amazing. I can't wait to see what that is.
Oh my god. Okay, maybe it's the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari with Nicolas Cage.
Oh, could you imagine Nicolas Cage hamming it up in that kind of film? That would be like, oh, he'd definitely get his second Oscar for that.
So anyway, let's go back to the 1920s now.
So yeah, I feel like there's some again, this is part of the Eureka Masters of Cinema Entertainment, and I did watch this last October, or no, actually I saw it a couple of Octobers ago, but anyway, it's one of those films, again, I was familiar with it, I was familiar with the imagery because those things have been projected everywhere, and Rob Zombie even used this movie as inspiration for the music video for his song Living Dead Girl, which is a song that plays at the beginning of Bride of Chucky, if people remember that. So yeah, it's got Conrad Veidt, who was kind of like the Lon Chaney of Lon Chaney Senior of German cinema, who was in Casablanca, and he was also in The Man Who Laughs, Thief of Baghdad, Waxworks, and also The Hands of Orlok. And his performance, and
it has to be said, he was a committed and passionate anti-Nazi who fled the regime. And obviously his most famous movie role is as an evil Nazi in Casablanca. So that's there you go.
Interesting. Yeah. So his performance, I feel, laid the groundwork for, you know, the tormented and maybe even a bit misunderstood monsters of the 1930s. I could sort of, you know, you could see maybe a bit of his performance in, or a bit of that aspect in Boris Karloff's performance as the monster in Frankenstein. And there's some, you know, the set design is amazing, great use of camera work, also a great ending as well. I won't spoil it, but it's a good ending. It's a film, you know, that's very allegorical about 1920s Germany and also the First World War. So it's a film that's got a lot on its mind, you know, frightening, and with, you know, with some great thematic moments to it.
Yeah, I think it's tremendous. Another one that you could project on the walls of your Halloween party and do very well with. It's like a highway, single lane highway straight from this movie to the Universal pictures, but obviously it's superior to so many of those. And yeah, the ending is interesting. I don't know if I agree that it's a great ending, but it's certainly a sort of like ending. I do love this film. It's very good. So what's your number? Wait, what am I? My number one is my
number one. Yes, your number.
My number one is French film, Danish director, for me, the pinnacle of silent cinema, 1928's The Passion of Joan of Arc.
I wanted to try and watch this before this episode and try and see if it could make onto my list, but I ran out of time, but I will definitely
would have done. It's Carl Theodore Dreyer. One of the handful of films he made that are all, you know, just his CV is short but incredible. The Day of Wrath, Vampire, Gertrude. He didn't get to make enough films in his time, but my goodness me, Joan of Arc is an absolute just masterpiece. The whole thing revolves around the trial of Joan of Arc, I mean, and then her eventual martyrdom. And it's the way in which he depicts this, you know, tussle within Joan's own mind, you know, between wanting to save herself and wanting to save her soul, is fantastic. But, you know, that so much of that, the honor of why that works belongs to Maria Falconetti. What Dreyer builds around her is really just an amazing set, and then has the film edited in such a way that you are really just sort of seeing Joan, you know, through the eyes of her inquisitors, but also the cameras turned back on them. And I mean, I think it's a wonderful statement about tyranny. And for all the fact that Dreyer, I don't think ever, you know, he said he never intended these films to be sort of political, but I think you can't look at this and not see the sort of politics in it. And, you know, the later film Day of Wrath, which he actually made in Denmark during the Nazi occupation, has similar themes. But it's this film that just sort of rises above the rest. This is his sort of iconic contribution to cinema. And yeah, you've got to go watch it, man. It's just, and I everyone out there should watch this movie. There's nothing quite like it. And it sounds maybe like it might not be very interesting, but it's a short 82 minute long.
Yeah.
Just character study, but also parable, also critique of religion, and then this outpouring at the end of feeling as Joan is martyred in a very visceral way, I will say. And I mean, you're not expecting how it will go. It feels like well and truly sort of biblical, this film.
But his films were very religious, and I think I think we did bring this up on a Holmes Movies Recommends episode, probably when we were talking about Oil, the word. It's like a list of the from the Vatican. It's their list of important films, and it's like because of what it says about religion. And then there's a bunch of other films
they're a big fan of this. I mean, yeah, it's not one. It's not anti-religion. I mean, it's a deeply religious film. I think it's anti-clerical in some ways. But yeah. Anyway, we can get into the weeds on that. What's your number one?
So that's my number one is a film that was a bit low on your list, so we're getting back to it now. It's Femur Now. He's been showing up a lot on this list, which also makes me realize I've not watched that many 1920s films. Nosferatu. Das Vampir.
Well, yeah, I mean, but this is a great movie. I mean, it's Symphonie des Grauens. Eine Symphonie des Grauens. F.W. Murnau. 1922. The film that nearly
nearly got lost because of a copyright issue because
Bram Stoker's wife tried to get them all destroyed or something.
Yeah, like it was. I mean, essentially Nosferatu. It changes some names, but the storyline is the same as
Dracula.
Bram Stoker's Dracula, which is a fantastic book. It's been adapted a few times. Nicolas Cage,
once or twice.
Nicolas Cage actually played Dracula in the film Renfield, which came out last year, and that's a lot of fun. He's just, you know, beautiful in that film. I think they didn't get the rights or something like that, and I think it was just, you know, the estate or the wife, they were like, burn every copy, but one copy did survive. And I think we have the BFI version or one or something like that, where it was a restored version of the film and they were able to kind of complete the film together, because I feel like some reels of the film were missing for like a long period of time. And that's also a really sad thing as well. A lot of silent movies don't exist anymore because of A, they haven't been well preserved properly, or they blew up because of a studio fire. But it's great, some films like Nosferatu.
Well, they've just been lost. They've just been literally lost, some of them. You know, like it's very sad when you look through the cinematographies of great directors and actors from this period, and so many of the films just do not exist. There is no way to watch them. So this is the thing, you know, these films are worth preserving and saving. And the only way to do that is to ensure that they get restored, re-released, backed up, digitized, preserved in film registries, etc. And thank goodness Nosferatu is that, because it's just Nosferatu. I mean, they got this dude to play Count Orlok, aka Dracula, who just is the most vampire looking motherfucker in the history of Max Schreck, whose last name literally means fear.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the character that Christopher Walken plays in Batman Returns. He's literally called Max Schreck.
There you go.
Yeah.
And then they did a film where Willem Dafoe played him in the Shadow of the Vampire.
Yeah, there's a movie called Shadow of the Vampire, which is a film about the making of Nosferatu, and John Malkovich plays Murnau. And it's also got Eddie Izzard playing in the film as well. He plays one of the actors who goes to the castle, and essentially, you know, it's like Max Schreck, he's a bit of a method actor, so we have to shoot this film at night and away from daylight. And apparently Max Schreck, who was a very mysterious actor, and there's not much backstory about him, but he was a very sort of method actor, and I think from all reports
literally a vampire. They got a vampire to play a vampire.
Yeah, literally, and that's true. And Willem Dafoe is great in the film. I think it's also produced by Nicolas Cage, that film. And in a very cool roundabout sort of way, Willem Dafoe, who was in Shadow of the Vampire, played Max Schreck, got an Oscar nomination, is going to play in the new version of Nosferatu, which is directed by Robert Eggers, who did The Witch, The Lighthouse, and The Northman, starring Bill Skarsgård and Lily Rose Depp. And Bill Skarsgård, you know, Alexander Skarsgård's little brother, and, you know, part of the Skarsgård family, he's playing Count Orlok.
What? Okay. And then there's the version of Nosferatu that was done by your friend and mine.
Werner Herzog with Klaus Kinski.
I would love to watch that
because Klaus Kinski's playing the vampire. I would love to see that.
Yeah. But look, the original Nosferatu is fabulous. It is it's super evocative. It's brilliantly creepy, and it's got those iconic shots of Orlok stalking.
Great shadow.
You know, the
shadow.
Yeah,
right. It's just like the bit where it's nightmare inducing. That whole it's that child thing where you're under your covers and the monster's gonna grab you and everything.
And he's got those long fingers, and they do this. There's some really fun like location work that's done out in like Transylvania or wherever the hell they filmed it. But it's so good, and it's so again, it's like this is where they're setting the standard for what scary looks like on screen. Because I think that scary in Victorian era theatre or in literature or early cinema, it's like a lot of the scares that we see aren't that scary now, maybe to our eyes. But this starts to look scary, and I think builds a foundation for the horror stuff that comes later.
Yeah.
It's just a shame that he didn't get the rights for his literary adaptation, because, you know, the movie nearly passed out of existence. So also an early lesson is, if you're going to do a literary adaptation, sort your fucking copyright out so that you don't get your film destroyed.
I was just looking a little bit on Wikipedia. Conrad Veidt nearly did play Count Orlok. He was offered the role, but he couldn't take on the role because of a scheduling conflict.
Well, there you go. Well, look, that has been a fantastic list. I've loved this decade's project. We're not going to do the 1910s because, like, fucking hell, like, you know, it's just it, that seems like that might be too much to ask. But you know, this I think is our attempt to say to you, you know, go out and watch silent films, we'll stay in and watch silent films. Watch every film on this list is a doozy. Like, you will not be disappointed. You should enjoy them. You should watch them not as novelties, but just as films, and you'll be surprised how quickly your eyes will adapt to watching silent cinema. So yeah, that's the top 10 of the 1920s. We've done 10 films for 10 decades or something. Listen to the sequence of episodes we've made for you. They're fantastic.
So we started with 2010s all the way down to, you know, down to the 1920s. I guess when this decade is over, we'll probably do a top 10 of the 2020s.
Yes, we will. We'll do that. Absolutely. All right. But until then, you're going to have to make do with our going back and listening to all the old episodes. When the new episodes on the trilogies come out, listen to those. And then, of course, we're going to do our Movies and Me and
trilogy episodes.
And obviously, when awards season rolls on next year, we'll do alternative Oscars. There's lots coming your way.
So you can check out the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Acast. We're on Spotify. You can also follow our Instagram page at Holmes Movies Pod. You can also check out our blog as well, which I guess is sort of turning into just me rambling about movies. You can read my review of Dune Part 2, which is amazing.
But not from the 1920s.
The 2020s. The 2020s, yes.
It is kind of amazing to think that we're talking about films on this episode that are 100 years old.
That is true. Yeah, that is true. A lot of films this year are there's some very
we have to go.
There's some very big cinematic milestones coming. But yes, we have to go because Adam's got a baby to look after. But anyway, yes, do check back with us and look forward to our trilogy episodes and more Movies and Me episodes. Yes, I've been Anders Holmes.
I'm Adam Holmes. Have fun, guys. Take care of yourselves. Yes. Watch movies.
Bye.